You are listening to a recording made available by the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry, Incorporated, as a service to God's people. This is message number 4 of 12 on the Book of Daniel by Dr. Reynold Showers. This message is entitled, God's Sovereign Rule Over Gentile Rulers.
When we come to Daniel chapter 4, we have the record of God's sovereign rule over Gentile rulers demonstrated. God's sovereign rule over Gentile rulers demonstrated. Daniel chapter 4 is unique in at least one respect. We are convinced that all the other chapters of the book of Daniel were written by the prophet Daniel himself. But that was not true of the fourth chapter of this book. Daniel chapter 4 was written by King Nebuchadnezzar himself. The opening section of Daniel chapter 4 indicates this to us. The opening section is contained in verses 1 through 3 and could be entitled Nebuchadnezzar's Royal Proclamation. And notice how it begins. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language that live in all the earth, may your peace abound. It has seemed good to me to declare the signs and wonders which the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. This opening royal proclamation indicates to us that King Nebuchadnezzar wrote the fourth chapter of the book of Daniel as a royal proclamation sometime after the events recorded in verses 4 through 37 had transpired. The experience recorded for us in verses 4 through 37 had already happened in the life of this very powerful king of Babylon. And because of the lessons that he had learned through God's unique dealing with him, he decided that he had better write a special proclamation to all the subjects of his kingdom. And he writes that royal proclamation so that the people of his kingdom might learn through his experience the lesson that God had taught to him in a very difficult way. And that was the lesson that it is the Most High God, Jehovah the God of Israel, who is sovereign over all the affairs of men and of kingdoms on planet Earth. In the second major section of Daniel chapter 4, which is contained in verses 4 through 18, we have Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Now, we've already noted two sessions ago, the first dream that Nebuchadnezzar received from God is recorded for us in Daniel chapter 2. But here, sometime later, Nebuchadnezzar has a second dream, again from God. And he tells us, verse 4, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and flourishing in my palace. Now that statement tells us during what part of Nebuchadnezzar's reign he received this dream from God. Ancient historical records tell us that during the first half of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, he was away from home during most of the time because it was during the first half of Nebuchadnezzar's reign that he was out on the battlefield, conquering greater and greater areas of the world and enlarging his great empire. But halfway through his reign, Nebuchadnezzar did a complete change in his policies. He stopped his conquests. And he decided to stay at home. And as a result, the latter half of his reign was characterized by great peace and prosperity within the realm of Babylon. And so Nebuchadnezzar, in essence, is telling us that this unique event in which God dealt with him in a sovereign way took place during the latter half of his reign, while he was staying home and was at peace and enjoying great prosperity. He indicates to us in verse 5, that this particular dream, as was true with his first one in chapter 2, again was a very disturbing dream. He says at the end of verse 5 that it kept alarming him. Again, with tremendous curiosity, he was wondering what could possibly be the significance or meaning of this dream for him. And so, as he had done in the past, once again we find, when we come to verses 6 and 7, that he called in all the different classes of the wise men. This time he told them the content of the dream and asked them to give him the interpretation. But this particular dream was so puzzling that these wise men were not even able to invent a plausible sounding interpretation for this dream. They were completely stumped. And they had to confess again, they failed. They did not know what this dream could conceivably mean. Once again, as we've seen already in the last two chapters, for some reason, Daniel did not come in right away with the other wise men. But when we come to verse 8, we are told, finally, Daniel came in before me, King Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar, remembering that Daniel had been able to interpret his dream back in chapter 2, says to him, I've had another dream. Here's the content. Daniel, or as he calls him by his Babylonian name, Belteshazzar, you have already demonstrated very clearly that you've got a special connection with a supernatural God who is able to unlock the mystery of dreams and visions. And so I'm asking you, would you please once again unlock for me the mystery of this particular dream and interpret it for me? And he spells out to Daniel the content of the dream. He says that in this dream he saw a gigantic tree, so huge in size that it reached into the very heavens themselves, and so enormous that it could be seen over the then civilized populated world. This tree with its great branches was loaded with all sorts of foodstuffs and fruit. And as a result, it provided both safe lodging and also sustenance for the birds of the air, for the beasts of the field, and for many peoples of the world. A magnificent tree to behold in this particular dream. But that was not the only thing that was in the dream. As Nebuchadnezzar was observing this tree in this dream, all of a sudden there was a unique figure that he calls a holy watcher. Most scholars are convinced that this is an angel who came down out of heaven and gave a command with regard to this tree. The angel commanded that this enormous tree was to be cut down and destroyed. Only the stump of the tree was to be allowed to remain in the ground. And that stump was to be bound with a metallic band. And then the heart, the inner control center of a wild beast, was to be placed inside the stump of the tree. We are told in verse 17 that the angel spells out the purpose of this dream and what it signified. The angel says, this sentence is by the decree of the angelic watchers, and the decision is a command of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whom he wishes and sets over it the lowliest of men. The word that is translated lowliest means the humblest of men, those from very humble background. That was a very significant statement because Nebuchadnezzar's father, Nabopolassar, who had been king before Nebuchadnezzar, repeatedly in his inscriptions that archaeologists have uncovered, made this statement concerning himself, I am the son of a nobody. Evidently, Nebuchadnezzar's father had come from a very humble background, not a prominent family, not even a royal family, within the kingdom of Babylon. And God is saying here that as he exercises his sovereign rule in the kingdom of men. Sometimes he raises up as rulers over the kingdom of men, men who come from a very humble, almost unknown background to serve his will and his purpose in the world. But the whole purpose of this dream and what it signified was to demonstrate to Nebuchadnezzar first, and then through him to his subjects and people who would read his royal proclamation, the fact that it is the Most High God, the God of Israel, who is sovereign over the rule and the affairs of mankind on planet Earth. And Nebuchadnezzar, verse 18, concludes his account of his dream by saying to Daniel, "This is the dream which I, King Nebuchadnezzar, have seen. Now you, Belteshazzar, or Daniel, tell me its interpretation, inasmuch as none of the wise men of my kingdom is able to make known to me the interpretation. But you are able, for a spirit of the holy gods is in you." Again, he's a pagan man, and this was his pagan way of saying, I know you've got connections with a supernatural God who's able to unlock these kind of mysteries. That brings us to the third section of chapter 4, which we could entitle Daniel's Reaction to the Dream. This is found in verse 19. Nebuchadnezzar indicates to us that when Daniel heard the content of this dream, and evidently as God was revealing to him its interpretation, Daniel was shocked by the implication of this dream. Because as Daniel received the interpretation of the dream from God, he realized that this dream had terrible significance for King Nebuchadnezzar. And interestingly, even though Daniel was a man of God and Nebuchadnezzar was still a pagan man, Daniel evidently had come to have great respect for this great Gentile ruler. And because of that, Daniel hesitated. He didn't want to drop the bad news upon King Nebuchadnezzar. And he began to hedge. And Nebuchadnezzar recognized that, and he began to press Daniel. And he says in the middle of verse 19, "Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation alarm you. Tell me, what does it mean? Don't hold anything back." And Daniel responded to the king, in essence, by saying, "My lord, if only this dream, with its terrible foreboding, would apply to your enemies rather than to you." This was Daniel's way of forewarning the king, the news is not good. The interpretation of this dream is going to have terrible consequences for you as an individual. And how I wish those terrible consequences could fall upon your enemies rather than upon you yourself. That brings us to the next section of chapter 4, and this is contained in verses 20 through 27, and we could entitle this section, Daniel Interprets the Dream. In verses 20 and 21, and also verse 22, Daniel tells King Nebuchadnezzar that this magnificent tree that was in the dream represents King Nebuchadnezzar himself. This great tree that had grown to such gigantic proportions and that was filled with all sorts of foodstuffs for the creatures of God that lived upon planet Earth. Now, this raises an interesting question. Why would God portray Nebuchadnezzar by such a great tree, supplying foodstuffs to God's creatures on the face of the earth? Rather strange way to represent a human being by a tree. Well, there are a couple reasons why God chose to portray the king in this fashion. Daniel tells us very clearly one of the reasons. It's the fact that this great tree with its gigantic size very appropriately represented the tremendous power and influence that Nebuchadnezzar had developed for himself in the known world at that particular time. But some of the ancient Babylonian records give us another indicator why God chose to represent King Nebuchadnezzar by this great tree. In some of the writings of King Nebuchadnezzar himself that archaeologists have uncovered, they've been very intrigued to find that Nebuchadnezzar repeatedly talked about the gigantic cedar trees of Lebanon that he had witnessed with his own eyes when he had been on military campaigns over there in the land of Lebanon. And Nebuchadnezzar indicated in some of his writings that he was so intrigued by those gigantic cedar trees of Lebanon that as far as he was concerned, they were the greatest living thing on the face of the earth. And he made statements to the effect that he'd never seen such a thing before in all of his life. And evidently, because the king was so enamored by such great trees, God decided to portray the king himself by such a great tree in his dream. Why would God portray him as a tree that was supplying great food for the creatures of God on planet earth? Well, again, archaeologists have found in many of Nebuchadnezzar's personal writings that repeatedly he boasted over the fact of how well he supplied food for the subjects of his kingdom. He was proud over that ministry of his administration. And so God again portrayed him in that fashion as a great supplier of foodstuffs for the creatures of the earth. But Daniel goes on, and beginning with verse 23, he begins to deal with the command of this angel who came down out of heaven in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, and the angel commanding the great tree to be cut down. And Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar the fact that the tree was chopped down was God's way of indicating to Nebuchadnezzar that the king himself, in spite of how great and powerful he was, would be removed from the throne of Babylon. God, in essence, would chop him down and cut him off from his sphere of rule and power for a designated period of time. But Daniel goes on and he deals with the fact that even though the tree was cut down in the dream, the stump of the tree was commanded to be left in the ground. And Daniel interpreted that and said, "This is God's way of saying to you, King Nebuchadnezzar, when you finally learn the lesson that this judgment of God upon you is designed to teach you, God will restore you to the throne." So the very fact that part of the tree was allowed to remain in the ground was God's way of signifying to Nebuchadnezzar that eventually he would be restored to the throne as the king of Babylon again, after he had learned God's designed lesson. What about the metal band that was to be put around the stump? Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar this was God's way of indicating that Nebuchadnezzar himself would be bound with a form of mental illness. And it would be that mental illness that would make it necessary for the king to be removed from the throne for a period of time. But what about the heart of a wild beast being placed into the stump of the tree? Well, Daniel said, this is God's way of saying to you that with this form of mental illness that you will suffer, you will act, you will live like a wild beast. And as you begin to act that way, it will be necessary for the other officials of the kingdom to drive you out of the royal palace and even out of the capital city of Babylon. You will live in the open fields like a wild animal. You will sleep out there at night in the open. And as the dew falls upon your head during the night, your hair, as it grows long, will become matted like the feathers of a bird. Your fingernails will grow long like the claws of a beast. You will go around on all fours, and you will graze in the fields like a wild animal. You will eat the grass of the field. That will be your diet, just like a wild animal. He would indeed live the life of a wild beast because of this form of mental illness that God would bring upon him. And notice verse 26, actually again, verse 25, the end of it, he says that this would happen to the king until seven periods of time would pass over him. Now, we have to confess our ignorance. We don't know exactly how long each one of those periods of time was to be. We don't know if that was to be 7 months, or 7 weeks, or 7 days, or 7 years. The book of Daniel doesn't tell us, and neither does a secular historical reference to this form of mental illness on Nebuchadnezzar that I want to refer to later on indicate to us exactly how long this was. But God had a length of time set. And he says to him, seven times will pass over you until you recognize, end of verse 25, that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. And in it was commanded to leave the stump with the roots of the tree. Your kingdom will be assured to you after you recognize that it is heaven that rules ultimately over the affairs of men. Not man, but ultimately it is heaven that rules over the affairs of men. And in verse 27, in light of this terrible message that Daniel had to deliver to the king, he pleads with the king to stop some of his brutal ways of ruling over the poor people of his kingdom. Ancient records tell us that sometimes Nebuchadnezzar could be very brutal. He enslaved many people, especially poor people, and treated them in terrible ways. And Daniel is saying to him, O king, please accept my advice to you. Stop these evil ways with the poor people of your kingdom. And perhaps, if you do that, God will prolong the time of your prosperity as king over Babylon. The interpretation of the dream. And that brings us now to the next major section of chapter 4, which is contained in verses 28 through 33, and which we could entitle the fulfillment of the dream. There have been many people, especially skeptics of the Bible, who, as they have read or heard about this account, have said that is just too preposterous to have happened. Nothing so spectacular as this could have ever happened to such a powerful man as King Nebuchadnezzar. But keep in mind, Nebuchadnezzar is the one who is writing this account, and notice what he says in verse 28. It's almost as if Nebuchadnezzar anticipated that some skeptics would say this is too preposterous to believe. He says, verse 28, all this happened to Nebuchadnezzar the king. As impossible as it may seem, Nebuchadnezzar is saying, it actually happened. And I'm testifying to it before the whole world. This actually happened to me as the king of Babylon. He tells us in verse 29 that this judgment of God came upon him 12 months or 1 year after he had received the dream from God. And he tells us where he was and what he was doing on the occasion that the judgment fell upon him. Verse 29, 12 months later, he, Nebuchadnezzar, was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. Now, we know from Babylonian records that at this particular time there were three royal palaces in the city of Babylon. The question is, which royal palace was Nebuchadnezzar walking upon the roof of at this particular time? Most scholars are convinced that he was walking on the roof of the royal palace that had the world-famous Hanging Gardens of Babylon upon the roof. The reason they conclude that is because that particular royal palace was built upon the highest elevation in the city of Babylon. And so, walking on the roof of that particular royal palace, Nebuchadnezzar would himself be on the highest elevation, and from that vantage point could look out over the whole magnificent capital city of Babylon, which is exactly what he tells us in verse 30 he was doing. He was looking over this great city. And he was boasting over how great it was. Look at verse 30. The king reflected and said, is this not Babylon the great, which I myself have built as a royal residence by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty. What's his problem? Why did God have to judge him? He's on an ego trip. And he's boasting and saying, look at this magnificent city. And by the way, from all we know, it was the greatest city on the face of the earth at this time. Look at what I have been able to do by myself. I'm the one who made this great city what it is. I have done it by the might of my power. And I did it for one purpose, and that is to bring glory to my majesty. He was thinking, I'm number one in the world. And I've demonstrated it through my great power of making Babylon so great. His big problem was pride. From a purely human viewpoint, Nebuchadnezzar had good reason to boast on this particular day. Let me tell you why. Again, we know from ancient Babylonian records that he did indeed carry on magnificent building projects within the city of Babylon during his reign. For instance, he personally had 3 pagan religious temples remodeled. Now, they had continued in use, but they had been allowed to degenerate, and he personally had those 3 great pagan temples remodeled. In addition, he had 15 more pagan religious temples restored. These were ones that had gone out of use for a period of time and had been boarded up, and Nebuchadnezzar had them completely restored and put back into use again. In addition to that, he had several brand new pagan temples, magnificent pagan temples built from scratch within the great city of Babylon. His father, Nabopolassar, who had already had a magnificent royal palace in the city, after Nabopolassar had died, that royal palace also had been allowed to degenerate and decay. And Nebuchadnezzar had that royal palace completely restored, but he wasn't satisfied to have one royal palace. He built 2 more, greater royal palaces for himself within the city of Babylon, so he ended up with 3. Royal palaces in which to live. He could move from one part of the city to the other. Whenever he got tired of one royal palace, he had 2 more he could visit and enjoy. He was determined to make the city of Babylon unconquerable. I remember back in these days, for protection, it was the custom to build great walls around cities to keep out the enemy. Every other city, at least the majority of them, had 1 great wall around them. Nebuchadnezzar wasn't satisfied with just 1 wall. He had to have 2 complete walls. One within the other was space in between. And so he had built 2 magnificent walls the whole way around the capital city of Babylon. And in order to guarantee that no enemy could ever knock a hole in those walls with instruments of warfare available at that time, he had each of those walls built so thick that at their most narrow point, which was at the top, each wall was wide enough for 4 chariots to race side by side at breakneck speed around the top of those walls without falling off. There were no battering rams or instruments of warfare known to man at that time that could knock a hole in either one of those walls. Of course, soldiers can scale walls if they can't break through. They can climb over them to get into your city. And so he decided he'd take care of that. He had fortresses and fortress towers and ramparts built in each of these walls so close together that it would have been absolute suicide for any enemy soldiers to try to scale those walls, because as they would be trying to come up over those walls, his archers and spearmen and these fortresses and fortress towers could pick off the enemy soldiers like flies. And even if an enemy soldier was able to get over the first wall, when he would drop down into the open space between the first and the second wall again, he would be like a sitting duck for the archers and spearmen on top of both walls. It was absolutely impossible for enemy troops to get inside that city through conventional means. Nebuchadnezzar had it built that way, and as a result, his city of Babylon had a world reputation of being the city that could never be conquered by an enemy. Now keep that in mind, because that will play a very significant role when we look at chapter 5, the next chapter in our next session. In addition, he had magnificent avenues or streets laid out and built from one end of the city of Babylon to the other. It was the showpiece of the ancient world. He had a tremendous canal system dug from one end of the city to the other, so that businessmen could travel from one part of the city to the other by boat to carry on their trade and their business. He made it the Fort Lauderdale of the ancient world. On top of that, coming through the main part of the two walls, he built a magnificent gate that was called the Ishtar Gate. It was a beautiful thing to behold. He had his craftsmen make ceramic tile of brilliant colors, and they covered the whole outside of that gate, the walls of it, and all the rest, the ramparts coming into it, with beautiful designs of lions and animals and flowers. That itself had a tremendous reputation. If you ever have opportunity to go to the city of Chicago, go sometime to the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago. There in that museum are some of the glazed tile of that Ishtar Gate from the ancient city of Babylon. They are beautiful to behold. But in spite of all this great building activity, that still wasn't the greatest achievement. Nebuchadnezzar, like other ancient kings, would marry foreign princesses for political purposes, to establish treaties with the nations from which those foreign princesses would come. And he wanted to have a special treaty with the kingdom of Media, the land of the Medes, who later on, in future years, would be instrumental in bringing about the downfall of the kingdom of Babylon. And so in order to get that treaty, he married the royal princess of the royal family of the kingdom of Media. And when that woman came to Babylon to become just one of many wives of King Nebuchadnezzar, she wasn't there very long until she became extremely homesick. Her nation was very mountainous. Beautiful mountains covered with all sorts of luxurious forests and vegetation. But when she came to Babylon, she found to her chagrin, there was no mountain in sight from the city of Babylon. The land around there was flat as a pancake and very little vegetation. And she grows so homesick for her land of the mountains that she threatened to leave Nebuchadnezzar and go back home. And that would have been politically embarrassing for this powerful king. He didn't dare allow it to happen. So in order to keep her there, he said, all right, if you want mountains and forests, we'll bring them to you. And one of the great royal palaces that he had built, he had it designed and built in such a way that his engineers could literally build mountains on top of this royal palace, and they did, and they planted trees and forests on top of the mountains, on top of the roof of this royal palace. Unbelievable engineering feat. And this became known as the Hanging Gardens of Babylon and became one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. And word of that spread throughout the civilized world of ancient times, and people traveled hundreds, if not thousands of miles to come to the city of Babylon just to see that great wonder of that time. From a totally human viewpoint, no wonder he was on top of the roof of this royal palace that night and boasting, is this not Babylon the Great, that I have made with the greatness of my power and for the glory of my majesty? He's on an ego trip. He's proud. He's boasting. But look at verse 31. While the word was in the king's mouth, a voice came from heaven saying, and now a word from your creator. In essence, that's what God was saying. God interrupted his boasting and said, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is declared, sovereignty has been removed from you. And you will be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place will be with the beasts of the field, You will be given grass to eat like cattle, and 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. And Nebuchadnezzar says, immediately the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. And he was driven away from mankind and began eating grass like cattle. And his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. It happened to him, just as God had forewarned. And he began acting and living like a wild beast. Historical records indicate to us that Nebuchadnezzar is not the only human being during the course of world history to suffer from this form of mental illness. There have been other people who have suffered a similar fate. And because of that, there is a technical medical term for this type of mental illness that Nebuchadnezzar had brought upon him. The name of this illness is lycanthropy. L-Y-C-A-N-T-H-R-O-P-Y. Lycanthropy. Now again, as I've indicated before, some people have said this is too preposterous to believe. Nothing like this could have ever happened to this great king. But interestingly, there is at least one secular historical reference to the same thing happening to King Nebuchadnezzar. Several centuries later, there was a Gentile historian by the name of Megasthenes. He lived during the late 300s and early 200s B.C. Again, a pagan man, and as far as we know, never saw a copy of the book of Daniel. And yet, this Gentile historian also records the fact that such a form of mental illness befell King Nebuchadnezzar for a period of time, and that he acted like a wild beast, and was forced off the throne for a period of time. But after a while, his sanity returned, and he was restored to the kingdom of Babylon once again. So there is secular corroboration or agreement with this record that is in Daniel chapter 4. Now this brings us to the last section of the chapter contained in verses 34 through 37, and we could entitle this Nebuchadnezzar's reaction to his judgment. He says, but at the end of that period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes, notice the direction, toward heaven. He's making progress spiritually. Again, the Babylonians believed everything divine comes from the earth. But he's beginning to learn the lesson. The God of Israel who's been dealing with me is different. He's in heaven. And so he raised his eyes toward heaven. And when he did that, he says, my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and praised and honored him who lives forever. And notice what he writes here about Jehovah, one of the greatest expressions, again, of the sovereignty of God that we have in all the Word of God. He says of God, for his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation, and all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of earth, and no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? In essence, he's saying, nobody can reach out and spank God's hand and say, you are a naughty boy for having done that. God is sovereign in the affairs of man, and he works out his perfect will according to his decisions and purposes. Nebuchadnezzar has learned this. And as a result, learning that lesson, verse 36, he says, at that time my reason returned to me, and my majesty and splendor were restored to me for the glory of my kingdom. My counselors and my nobles began seeking me out. So I was reestablished in my sovereignty, and surpassing greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, here's a pagan king, but notice what he says. I praise, exalt, and honor the king of heaven. For all his works are true, and his ways just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride. There is tremendous application for us today. What is your attitude toward God? And the fact that God says to you, you are a sinner. You have done things that offend me, that violate my absolutes. And therefore you stand condemned, and you're headed for eternal judgment. But I've provided a way of salvation for you. I've sent my only begotten Son, Jesus Christ, into the world. He died on the cross to pay the penalty for your sins. And the proof that he paid the full price for your sins is that I raised him victorious from the grave. Now you can have full forgiveness of sin and the gift of eternal life and can be accepted by me if you will come my way. But there's only one way for salvation, and that is through faith in my Son. What is your attitude toward that? Are you so proud that you disagree with God and say, I don't care what you say, I have not offended you, I have not sinned? Or so proud that you say to God, I will come my own way. I will save myself if there's any saving to be done. I can do it on my own. Let me remind you, dear friend, if the sovereign God of the universe could humble such a powerful man as Nebuchadnezzar, who was the most powerful man on the face of the earth in his day, then who are you to think that you can get away with your pride and escape the judgment of God by thinking you can go your own way and reject what he has to say to you? God is able to humble the proud. As believers, very easy for us to become proud as well of our accomplishments that God has enabled us to do. Sometimes we as believers also have to be humiliated by God in order to be reminded of the fact again, we do not exist for our benefit and for our glory. We exist for one purpose, and one purpose alone, and that is for God's benefit, and to honor and glorify Him, who alone is the sovereign Lord of this universe. May God help us to learn that lesson through the experience of this great king, Nebuchadnezzar. Father, again, we worship you. We adore you. We bow before you as the only true and living God. There is no one else like you, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, the triune God. It is you who created the universe, the earth, and all that in them is. It is you who has made us man. We have not made ourselves. It is you who made us for your purposes and for your glory. May we never forget that. And Lord, in contrast with you, the inhabitants of the earth are as grasshoppers. The nations of the world, when combined together, are no more significant in contrast with you than that one last little drop of water that's left in the corner bottom of a bucket after the rest of the water has been dumped out. All of mankind taken together is no greater in contrast with you as the great God of the universe than that little speck of grain dust that's left on the balances after the grain has been emptied into the sack. Lord, renew our perspective of who you are. And as a result, give us a holy sense of awe and reverence and respect for the King of this universe. In Jesus' blessed name, we ask and thank you for these things. Amen.
A free catalog listing other titles in our cassette library will be sent to you upon request. Simply address your request to the Friends of Israel, Post Office Box 123, West Collingswood, New Jersey, 08107.